hand waving to me. What was the nameless shadow which again in that one instant had passed? Chapter 33. In her furred travelling dress, Estella seemed more delicately beautiful than she had ever seemed yet, even in my eyes. Her manner was more winning than she had cared to let it be to me before, and I thought I saw Miss Havisham's influence in the change. We stood in the inn yard while she pointed out her luggage to me, and when it was all collected, I remembered, having forgotten everything but herself in the meanwhile, that I knew nothing of her destination. "I am going to Richmond," she told me. "Our lesson is that there are two Richmonds, one in Surrey and one in Yorkshire, and that mine is the Surrey Richmond. The distance is 10 miles. I am to have a carriage, and you are to take me. This is my purse, and you are to pay my charges out of it. Oh, you must take the purse. We have no choice, you and I, but to obey our instructions. We are not free to follow our own devices, you and I." As she looked at me in giving me the purse, I hoped there was an inner meaning in her words. She said them slightingly, but not with displeasure. "A carriage will have to be sent for, Estella. Will you rest here a little?" "Yes, I am to rest here a little, and I am to drink some tea, and you are to take care of me the while." She drew her arm through mine, as if it must be done, and I requested a waiter who'd been staring at the coach like a man who had never seen such a thing in his life, to show us a private sitting room. Upon that he pulled out a napkin, as if it were a magic clue without which he couldn't find the way upstairs, and led us to the black hole of the establishment, fitted up with a diminishing mirror, quite a superfluous article considering the hole's proportions, an anchovy sauce cruet, and somebody's patterns. On my objecting to this retreat, he took us into another room with a dinner table for 30, and in the grate a scorched leaf of a copybook under a bushel of coal dust. Having looked at this extinct conflagration and shaken his head, he took my order, which, proving to be merely "some tea for the lady," sent him out of the room in a very low state of mind. I was, and I am, sensible that the air of this chamber, in its strong combination of stable with soup stock, might have led one to infer that the coaching department was not doing well, and that the enterprising proprietor was boiling down the horses for the refreshment department. Yet the room was all in all to me, Estella being in it. I thought that with her I could have been happy there for life. I was not at all happy there at the time, observe, and I knew it well. "Where are you going to at Richmond?" I asked Estella. "I am going to live," said she, "at a great expense with a lady there, who has the power, or says she has, of taking me about and introducing me, and showing people to me and showing me to people." "I suppose you will be glad of variety and admiration." "Yes, I suppose so." She answered so carelessly that I said, "You speak of yourself as if you were someone else." "Where did you learn how I speak of others?" "Come, come," said Estella, smiling delightfully. "You must not expect me to go to school to you. I must talk in my own way. How do you thrive with Mr. Pocket?" "I live quite pleasantly there. At least—" It appeared to me that I was losing a chance. "At least," repeated Estella, "as pleasantly as I could anywhere, away from you." "You silly boy," said Estella quite composedly. "How can you talk such nonsense? Your friend Mr. Matthew, I believe, is superior to the rest of his family." "A very superior indeed. He is nobody's enemy, don't add but his own," interposed Estella, "for I hate that class of man. But he really is disinterested, and above small jealousy and spite, I have heard." "I am sure I have every reason to say so." "You have not every reason to say so of the rest of his people," said Estella, nodding at me with an expression of face that was at once grave and rallying, "for they beset Miss Havisham with reports and insinuations to your disadvantage. They watch you, misrepresent you, write letters about you, anonymous sometimes, and you are the torment and occupation of their lives. You can scarcely realize to yourself the hatred those people feel for you." "They do me no harm, I hope." Instead of answering, Estella burst out laughing. This was very singular to me, and I looked at her in considerable perplexity. When she left off, and she had not laughed languidly, but with real enjoyment, I said in my diffident way to her, "I hope I may suppose that you would not be amused if they did me any harm." "No, no, you may be sure of that," said Estella. "You may be certain that I laugh because they fail. Oh, those people with Miss Havisham and the tortures they undergo." She laughed again, and even now, when she had told me why, her laughter was very singular to me, for I could not doubt its being genuine, and yet it seemed too much for the occasion. I thought there must really be something more here than I knew. She saw the thought in my mind, and answered it. "It's not easy for even you," said Estella, "to know what satisfaction it gives me to see those people thwarted, or what an enjoyable sense of the ridiculous I have when they are made ridiculous. For you were not brought up in that strange house from a mere baby. I was. You had not your little wits sharpened by their intriguing against you, suppressed and defenceless under the mask of sympathy and pity and what not that is soft and soothing. I had. You did not gradually open your round, childish eyes wider and wider to the discovery of that imposter of a woman who calculates her stores of peace of mind for when she wakes up in the night. I did." It was no laughing matter with Estella now, nor was she summoning these remembrances from any shallow place. I would not have been the cause of that look of hers for all my expectations in a heap. "Two things I can tell you," said Estella. "First, notwithstanding the proverb, that constant dropping will wear away a stone, you may set your mind at rest that these people never will, never would, in 100 years, impair your ground with Miss Havisham, in any particular, great or small. Second, I am beholden to you as the cause of their being so busy and so mean in vain, and there is my hand upon it." As she gave it me playfully, for her darker mood had been but momentary, I held it and put it to my lips. "You ridiculous boy," said Estella, "will you never take warning, or do you kiss my hand in the same spirit in which I once let you kiss my cheek?" "What spirit was that?" said I. "I must think a moment. A spirit of contempt for the fawners and plotters. If I say yes, may I kiss the cheek again?" "You should have asked before you touched the hand. But yes, if you like." I leaned down, and her calm face was like a statue's. "Now," said Estella, gliding away the instant I touched her cheek, "you are to take care that I have some tea, and you are to take me to Richmond." Her reverting to this tone as if our association were forced upon us and we were mere puppets gave me pain. But everything in our intercourse did give me pain. Whatever her tone with me happened to be, I could put no trust in it and build no hope on it. And yet I went on against trust and against hope. Why repeat it 1,000 times? So it always was. I rang for the tea, and the waiter, reappearing with his magic clue, brought in by degrees some 50 adjuncts to that refreshment, but of tea not a glimpse. A tea-board, cups and saucers, plates, knives and forks, including carvers, spoons various, salt cellars, a meek little muffin confined with the utmost precaution under a strong iron cover. Moses in the bulrushes, typified by a soft bit of butter in a quantity of parsley. A pale loaf with a powdered head. 2 proof impressions of the bars of the kitchen fireplace on triangular bits of bread, and ultimately a fat family urn, which the waiter staggered in with, expressing in his countenance burden and suffering. After a prolonged absence at this stage of the entertainment, he at length came back with a casket of precious appearance containing twigs. These I steeped in hot water, and so from the whole of these appliances extracted 1 cup of I don't know what for Estella. The bill paid, and the waiter remembered, and the ostler not forgotten, and the chambermaid taken into consideration, in a word, the whole house bribed into a state of contempt and animosity, and Estella's purse much lightened, we got into our post-coach and drove away. Turning into Cheapside and rattling up Newgate Street, We were soon under the walls, of which I was so ashamed. "What place is that?" Estella asked me. I made a foolish pretense of not at first recognizing it, and then told her. As she looked at it, and drew in her head again, murmuring, "Wretches," I would not have confessed to my visit for any consideration. "Mr. Jaggers," said I, by way of putting it neatly on somebody else, "has the reputation of being more in the secrets of that dismal place than any man in London." "He is more in the secrets of every place, I think," said Estella in a low voice. "You've been accustomed to see him often, I suppose." "I have been accustomed to see him at uncertain intervals, ever since I can remember. But I know him no better now than I did before I could speak plainly."
"What is your own experience of him?"
"Do you advance with him?" "Once habituated to his distrustful manner," said I, "I've done very well." "Are you intimate?" "I have dined with him at his private house."
"I fancy," said Estella, shrinking, "that must be a curious place."
"It is a curious place." I should have been chary of discussing my guardian too freely, even with her, but I should have gone on with the subject so far as to describe the dinner in Gerrard Street, if we had not then come into a sudden glare of gas. It seemed, while it lasted, to be all alight and alive with that inexplicable feeling I had had before, and when we were out of it, I was as much dazed for a few moments as if I had been in lightning. So we fell into other talk, and it was principally about the way by which we were travelling, and about what parts of London lay on this side of it, and what on that. The great city was almost new to her, she told me, for she had never left Miss Havisham's neighbourhood until she had gone to France, and she had merely passed through London, then in going and returning. I asked her if my guardian had any charge of her while she remained here. To that she emphatically said, "God forbid," and no more. It was impossible for me to avoid seeing that she cared to attract me, that she made herself winning, and would have won me even if the task had needed pains. Yet this made me none the happier, for even if she had not taken that tone of our being disposed of by others, I should have felt that she held my heart in her hand because she wilfully chose to do it, and not because it would have wrung any tenderness in her to crush it and throw it away. When we passed through Hammersmith, I showed her where Mr. Matthew Pocket lived, and said it was no great way from Richmond, and that I hoped I should see her sometimes. "Oh yes, you are to see me. You are to come when you think proper. You are to be mentioned to the family. Indeed, you are already mentioned." I inquired, was it a large household she was going to be a member of? "No, there are only two, mother and daughter. The mother is a lady of some station, though not averse to increasing her income." "I wonder Miss Havisham could part with you again so soon."
"It is a part of Miss Havisham's plans for me, Pip," said Estella, with a sigh, as if she were tired. "I am to write to her constantly, and see her regularly, and report how I go on, I and the jewels, for they are nearly all mine now." It was the first time she had ever called me by my name. Of course she did so purposely, and knew that I would treasure it up. We came to Richmond all too soon, and our destination there was a house by the green, a staid old house where hoops and powder and patches, embroidered coats, rolled stockings, ruffles and swords had had their court days many a time. Some ancient trees before the house were still cut into fashions as formal and unnatural as the hoops and wigs and stiff skirts, but their own allotted places in the great procession of the dead were not far off, and they would soon drop into them and go the silent way of the rest. A bell with an old voice, which I dare say in its time had often said to the house, "Here is the green farthingale, here is the diamond-hilted sword, here are the shoes with red heels and the blue solitaire," sounded gravely in the moonlight, and two cherry-coloured maids came fluttering out to receive Estella. The doorway soon absorbed her boxes, and she gave me her hand and a smile, and said good night, and was absorbed likewise. And still I stood looking at the house, thinking how happy I should be if I lived there with her, and knowing that I never was happy with her, but always miserable. I got into the carriage to be taken back to Hammersmith, and I got in with a bad heartache, and I got out with a worse heartache. At our own door, I found little Jane Pocket coming home from a little party escorted by her little lover, and I envied her little lover, in spite of his being subject to Flopson. Mr. Pocket was out lecturing, for he was a most delightful lecturer on domestic economy, and his treatises on the management of children and servants were considered the very best textbooks on those themes. But Mrs. Pocket was at home, and was in a little difficulty on account of the baby's having been accommodated with a needle case to keep him quiet during the uncountable absence, with a relative and the foot guards, of Miller's. And more needles were missing than it could be regarded as quite wholesome for a patient of such tender years either to apply externally or to take as a tonic. Mr. Pocket, being justly celebrated for giving most excellent practical advice, and for having a clear and sound perception of things, and a highly judicious mind, I had some notion in my heartache of begging him to accept my confidence. But happening to look up at Mrs. Pocket as she sat reading her book of dignities after prescribing bed as a sovereign remedy for baby, I thought, well, no, I wouldn't. Chapter 34. As I had grown accustomed to my expectations, I had insensibly begun to notice their effect upon myself and those around me. Their influence on my own character I disguised from my recognition as much as possible, but I knew very well that it was not all good. I lived in a state of chronic uneasiness respecting my behaviour to Joe. My conscience was not by any means comfortable about Biddy. When I woke up in the night, like Camilla, I used to think with a weariness on my spirits that I should have been happier and better if I had never seen Miss Havisham's face, and had risen to manhood content to be partners with Joe in the honest old forge. Many a time of an evening, when I sat alone looking at the fire, I thought, after all, there was no fire like the forge fire and the kitchen fire at home. Yet Estella was so inseparable from all my restlessness and disquiet of mind that I really fell into confusion as to the limits of my own part in its production. That is to say, supposing I had had no expectations, and yet had had Estella to think of, I could not make out to my satisfaction that I should have done much better. Now, concerning the influence of my position on others, I was in no such difficulty, and so I perceived, though dimly enough perhaps, that it was not beneficial to anybody, and above all, that it was not beneficial to Herbert. My lavish habits led his easy nature into expenses that he could not afford, corrupted the simplicity of his life, and disturbed his peace with anxieties and regrets. I was not at all remorseful for having unwittingly set those other branches of the Pocket family to the poor arts they practised, because such littlenesses were their natural bent, and would have been evoked by anybody else if I had left them slumbering. But Herbert's was a very different case, and it often caused me a twinge to think that I had done him evil service in crowding his sparsely furnished chambers with incongruous upholstery work, and placing the canary-breasted Avenger at his disposal. So now, as an infallible way of making little ease great ease, I began to contract a quantity of debt. I could hardly begin, but Herbert must begin too, so he soon followed. At Startop's suggestion, we put ourselves down for election into a club called the Finches of the Grove, the object of which institution I have never divined, if it were not that the members should dine expensively once a fortnight, to quarrel among themselves as much as possible after dinner, and to cause six waiters to get drunk on the stairs. I know that these gratifying social ends were so invariably accomplished that Herbert and I understood nothing else to be referred to in the first standing toast of the society, which ran, "Gentlemen, may the present promotion of good feeling ever reign predominant among the Finches of the Grove." The Finches spent their money foolishly. The hotel we dined at was in Covent Garden, and the first Finch I saw when I had the honour of joining the Grove was Bentley Drummle, at that time floundering about town in a cab of his own, and doing a great deal of damage to the posts at the street corners. Occasionally he shot himself out of his equipage head foremost over the apron, and I saw him on one occasion deliver himself at the door of the grove in this unintentional way, like Coles. But here I anticipate a little, for I was not a Finch, and could not be, according to the sacred laws of the society, until I came of age. In my confidence in my own resources, I would willingly have taken Herbert's expenses on myself, but Herbert was proud, and I could make no such proposal to him. So he got into difficulties in every direction, and continued to look about him. When we gradually fell into keeping late hours and late company, I noticed that he looked about him with a desponding eye at breakfast time, that he began to look about him more hopefully about midday, that he drooped when he came into dinner, that he seemed to descry capital in the distance rather clearly after dinner, that he all but realized capital towards midnight, and that about 2 o'clock in the morning he became so deeply despondent again as to talk of buying a rifle and going to America with a general purpose of compelling buffaloes to make his fortune. I was usually at Hammersmith about half the week, and when I was at Hammersmith I haunted Richmond, whereof, separately, by and by, Herbert would come often to Hammersmith when I was there, and I think at those seasons his father would occasionally have some passing perception that the opening he was looking for had not appeared yet. But in the general tumbling up of the family, his tumbling out in life somewhere was a thing to transact itself somehow. In the meantime, Mr. Pocket grew greyer and tried oftener to lift himself out of his perplexities by the hair, while Mrs. Pocket tripped up the family with her footstool, read her book of dignities, lost her pocket-handkerchief, told us about her grandpapa, and taught the young idea how to shoot, by shooting it into bed whenever it attracted her notice. As I am now generalizing a period of my life with the object of clearing my way before me, I can scarcely do so better than by at once completing the description of our usual manners and customs at Barnard's Inn. We spent as much money as we could, and got as little for it as people could make up their minds to give us. We were always more or less miserable, and most of our acquaintance were in the same condition. There was a gay fiction among us that we were constantly enjoying ourselves, and a skeleton truth that we never did. To the best of my belief, our case was, in the last aspect, a rather common one. Every morning, with an air ever new, Herbert went into the city to look about him. I often paid him a visit in the dark back room in which he consorted with an ink jar, a hat peg, a coal box, a string box, an almanac, a desk and stool, and a ruler, and I do not remember that I ever saw him do anything else but look about him. If we all did what we undertake to do as faithfully as Herbert did, we might live in a republic of the virtues. He had nothing else to do, poor fellow, except at a certain hour of every afternoon to go to Lloyd's, in observance of a ceremony of seeing his principal, I think. He never did anything else in connection with Lloyd's that I could find out, except come back again. When he felt his case unusually serious, and that he positively must find an opening, he would go on change at a busy time, and walk in and out in a kind of gloomy country dance figure among the assembled magnates. "For," says Herbert to me, coming home to dinner on one of those special occasions, "I find the truth to be, Handel, that an opening won't come to one, but one must go to it. So I have been." If we had been less attached to one another, I think we must have hated one another regularly every morning. I detested the chambers beyond expression at that period of repentance, and could not endure the sight of the Avenger's livery, which had a more expensive and a less remunerative appearance then than at any other time in the 24 hours. As we got more and more into debt, breakfast became a hollower and hollower form, and being on one occasion at breakfast threatened, by letter, with legal proceedings, not unwholly unconnected, as my local paper might put it, with jewellery, I went so far as to seize the Avenger by his blue collar and shake him off his feet, so that he was actually in the air like a booted Cupid, for presuming to suppose that we wanted a roll. At certain times, meaning at uncertain times, for they depended on our humour, I would say to Herbert, as if it were a remarkable discovery, "My dear Herbert, we are getting on badly." "My dear Handel," Herbert would say to me in all sincerity, "if you will believe me, those very words were on my lips by a strange coincidence." "Then, Herbert," I would respond, "let us look into our affairs." We always derived profound satisfaction from making an appointment for this purpose. I always thought this was business. This was the way to confront the thing. This was the way to take the foe by the throat. And I know Herbert thought so, too. We ordered something rather special for dinner, with a bottle of something similarly out of the common way, in order that our minds might be fortified for the occasion, and we might come well up to the mark. Dinner over, we produced a bundle of pens, a copious supply of ink, and a goodly show of writing and blotting paper, for there was something very comfortable in having plenty of stationery. I would then take a sheet of paper and write across the top of it, in a neat hand, the heading, Memorandum of Pip's Debts, with Barnard's in and the date very carefully added. Herbert would also take a sheet of paper and write across it, with similar formalities, Memorandum of Herbert's Debts. Each of us would then refer to a confused heap of papers at his side, which had been thrown into drawers, worn into holes in pockets, half-burnt in lighting candles, stuck for weeks into the looking-glass, and otherwise damaged. The sound of our pens going refreshed us exceedingly, insomuch that I sometimes found it difficult to distinguish between this edifying business proceeding and actually paying the money. In point of meritorious character, the two things seemed about equal. When we had written a little, I would ask Herbert how he got on. Herbert probably would have been scratching his head in a most rueful manner at the sight of his accumulating figures. "They're mounting up, Handel," Herbert would say. "Upon my life, they are mounting up." "Be firm, Herbert," I would retort, plying my own pen with great assiduity. "Look the thing in the face. Look into your affairs. Stare them out of countenance." "So I would, Handel, only they're staring me out of countenance." However, my determined manner would have its effect, and Herbert would fall to work again. After a time, he would give up once more on the plea that he had not got Cobb's bill or Lobb's or Nobb's, as the case might be. Then Herbert estimate. Estimate it in round numbers and put it down. "What a fellow of resource you are," my friend would reply with admiration. "Really, your business powers are very remarkable." I thought so too. I established with myself on these occasions the reputation of a first-rate man of business, prompt, decisive, energetic, clear, cool-headed. When I got all my responsibilities down upon my list, I compared each with the bill and ticked it off. My self-approval, when I ticked an entry, was quite a luxurious sensation. When I had no more ticks to make, I folded all my bills up uniformly, docketed each one on the back, and tied the whole into a symmetrical bundle. Then I did the same for Herbert, who modestly said he had not my administrative genius, and felt that I had brought his affairs into focus for him. My business habits had one other bright feature, which I called leaving a margin. For example, supposing Herbert's debts to be £164.04, I would say, "Leave a margin and put them down at 200. Or supposing my own to be four times as much, I would leave a margin and put them down at 700. I had the highest opinion of the wisdom of this same margin, but I'm bound to acknowledge that on looking back, I deem it to have been an expensive device. For we always ran into new debt immediately, to the full extent of the margin, and sometimes, in the sense of freedom and solvency it imparted, got pretty far on into another margin. But there was a calm, a rest, a virtuous hush, consequent on these examinations of our affairs, that gave me, for the time, an admirable opinion of myself. Soothed by my exertions, my method, and Herbert's compliments, I would sit with this symmetrical bundle and my own on the table before me among the stationery, and feel like a bank of some sort, rather than a private individual. We shut our outer door on these solemn occasions in order that we might not be interrupted. I had fallen into my serene state one evening when we heard a letter drop through the slit in the said door and fall on the ground. "It's for you, Handel," said Herbert, going out and coming back with it. "And I hope there's nothing the matter." This was an allusion to its heavy black seal and border. The letter was signed Trabb and Company, and its contents were simply that I was an honoured sir, and that they begged to inform me that Mrs. J. Gargery had departed this life on Monday last at 6:20 in the evening, and that my attendance was requested at the interment on Monday next at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Chapter 35. It was the first time that a grave had opened in my road of life, and the gap it made in the smooth ground was wonderful. The figure of my sister in her chair by the kitchen fire haunted me night and day. That the place could possibly be without her was something my mind seemed unable to compass, and whereas she had seldom or never been in my thoughts of late, I had now the strangest ideas that she was coming towards me in the street, or that she would presently knock at the door. In my rooms, too, with which she had never been at all associated, there was at once the blankness of death and a perpetual suggestion of the sound of her voice or the turn of her face or figure, as if she were still alive and had been often there. Whatever my fortunes might have been, I could scarcely have recalled my sister with much tenderness. But I suppose there is a shock of regret which may exist without much tenderness. Under its influence, and perhaps to make up for the want of the softer feeling, I was seized with a violent indignation against the assailant from whom she had suffered so much, and I felt that on sufficient proof I could have revengefully pursued Orlick, or anyone else, to the last extremity. Having written to Joe to offer him consolation and to assure him that I would come to the funeral, I passed the intermediate days in the curious state of mind I have glanced at. I went down early in the morning and alighted at the Blue Boar in good time to walk over to the forge. It was fine summer weather again, and as I walked along, the times when I was a little helpless creature, and my sister did not spare me, vividly returned. But they returned with a gentler tone upon them that softened even the edge of Tickler. For now the very breath of the beans and clover whispered to my heart that the day must come when it will be well for my memory that others walking in the sunshine should be softened as they thought of me. At last I came within sight of the house, and saw that Trabb and company had put in a funereal execution and taken possession. Two dismally absurd persons, each ostentatiously exhibiting a crutch done up in a black bandage, as if that instrument could possibly communicate any comfort to anybody, were posted at the front door, and in one of them I recognized a postboy, discharged from the Boar for turning a young couple into a sawpit on their bridal morning, in consequence of intoxication, rendering it necessary for him to ride his horse clasped round the neck with both arms. All the children of the village, and most of the women, were admiring these sable warders and the closed windows of the house and forge, and as I came up, one of the two warders, the postboy, knocked at the door, implying that I was far too much exhausted by grief to have strength remaining to knock for myself. Another sable warder, a carpenter, who had once eaten two geese for a wager, opened the door and showed me into the best parlour. Here Mr. Trabb had taken unto himself the best table, and had got all the leaves up, and was holding a kind of black bazaar with the aid of a quantity of black pins. At the moment of my arrival he had just finished putting somebody's hat into black long clothes like an African baby, so he held out his hand for mine, but I, misled by the action and confused by the occasion, shook hands with him with every testimony of warm affection. Poor dear Joe, entangled in a little black cloak tied in a large bow under his chin, was seated apart at the upper end of the room, where, as chief mourner, he had evidently been stationed by Trabb. When I bent down and said to him, "Dear Joe, how are you?" he said, "Pep, old chap, you knowed her when she were a fine figure of a—" and clasped my hand, and said no more. Biddy, looking very neat and modest in her black dress, went quietly here and there, and was very helpful. When I had spoken to Biddy, as I thought it not a time for talking, I went and sat down near Joe, and there began to wonder in what part of the house it, she, my sister, was. The air of the parlour being faint with the smell of sweet cake, I looked about for the table of refreshments. It was scarcely visible until one had got accustomed to the gloom. But there was a cut-up plum-cake upon it, and there were cut-up oranges and sandwiches and biscuits, and two decanters that I knew very well as ornaments, but had never seen used in all my life, one full of port and one of sherry. Standing at this table, I became conscious of the servile Pumblechook in a black cloak and several yards of hatband, who was alternately stuffing himself and making obsequious movements to catch my attention. The moment he succeeded, he came over to me, breathing sherry and crumbs, and said in a subdued voice, "May I, dear sir?" and did. I then described Mr. and Mrs. Hubble, the last named in a decent speechless paroxysm in a corner. We were all going to follow, and were all in course of being tied up separately by Trab into ridiculous bundles. "Which I mean to say, Pep," Joe whispered me, as we were being what Mr. Trab called formed in the parlour two and two, and it was dreadfully like a preparation for some grim kind of dance. "Which I mean to say, sir, as I would in preference have carried her to the church myself, along with three or four friendly ones what come to it, with willing hearts and arms, but it were considered what the neighbours would look down on such, and would be of opinions as it were wanting in respect." "Pocket handkerchiefs out, all!" cried Mr. Trab at this point, in a depressed, business-like voice. "Pocket handkerchiefs out! We are ready!" So we all put our pocket handkerchiefs to our faces, as if our noses were bleeding, and filed out two and two. Joe and I, Biddy and Pumblechook, Mr. and Mrs. Hubble. The remains of my poor sister had been brought round by the kitchen door, and it being a point of undertaking ceremony that the six bearers must be stifled and blinded under a horrible black velvet housing with a white border, the whole looked like a blind monster with 12 human legs, shuffling and blundering along under the guidance of two keepers, the postboy and his comrade. The neighbourhood, however, highly approved of these arrangements, and we were much admired as we went through the village, the more youthful and vigorous part of the community making dashes now and then to cut us off, and lying in wait to intercept us at points of vantage. At such times, the more exuberant among them called out in an excited manner on our emergence round some corner of expectancy, "Here they come! Here they are!" And we were all but cheered. In this progress, I was much annoyed by the abject Pumblechook, who, being behind me, persisted all the way as a delicate attention in arranging my streaming hatband and smoothing my cloak. My thoughts were further distracted by the excessive pride of Mr. and Mrs. Hubble, who were surpassingly conceited and vainglorious in being members of so distinguished a procession. And now the range of marshes lay clear before us, with the sails of the ships on the river growing out of it, and we went into the churchyard, close to the graves of my unknown parents. Philip Pirrip, late of this parish, and also Georgiana, wife of the above. And there my sister was laid quietly in the earth, while the lark sang high above it, and the light wind strewed it with beautiful shadows of clouds and trees. Of the conduct of the worldly-minded Pumblechook, while this was doing, I desire to say no more than it was all addressed to me, and that even when those noble passages were read, which remind humanity how it brought nothing into the world and can take nothing out, and how it fleeth like a shadow and never continueth long in one stay, I heard him cough a reservation of the case of a young gentleman who came unexpectedly into large property. When we got back, he had the hardihood to tell me that he wished my sister could have known I had done her so much honour, and to hint that she would have considered it reasonably purchased at the price of her death. After that, he drank all the rest of the sherry, and Mr. Hubble drank the port, and the two talked, which I have since observed to be customary in such cases, as if they were of quite another race from the deceased, and were notoriously immortal. Finally, he went away with Mr. and Mrs. Hubble to make an evening of it, I felt sure, and to tell the jolly bargeman that he was the founder of my fortunes and my earliest benefactor. When they were all gone, and when Trab and his men, but not his boy, I looked for him, had crammed their mummery into bags and were gone too, the house felt wholesomer. Soon afterwards, Biddy, Joe, and I had a cold dinner together. But we dined in the best parlour, not in the old kitchen, and Joe was so exceedingly particular what he did with his knife and fork and the salt cellar and what not, that there was great restraint upon us. But after dinner, when I made him take his pipe, and when I had loitered with him about the forge, and when we sat down together on the great block of stone outside it, we got on better. I noticed that after the funeral, Joe changed his clothes, so far as to make a compromise between his Sunday dress and working dress, in which the dear fellow looked natural and liked the man he was. He was very much pleased by my asking if I might sleep in my own little room, and I was pleased too, for I felt that I had done rather a great thing in making the request. When the shadows of evening were closing in, I took an opportunity of getting into the garden with Biddy for a little talk. "Biddy," said I think you might have written to me about these sad matters."
"Do you, Mr. Pip?" said Biddy.
"I should have written if I'd thought that. Don't suppose that I mean to be unkind, Biddy, when I say I consider that you ought to have thought that. Do you, Mr. Pip?" She was so quiet, and had such an orderly, good, and pretty way with her, that I did not like the thought of making her cry again. After looking a little at her downcast eyes as she walked beside me, I gave up that point. "I suppose it will be difficult for you to remain here now, Biddy, dear."
"Oh, I can't do so, Mr. Pip," said Biddy in a tone of regret, but still of quiet conviction. "I've been speaking to Mrs. Hubble, and I'm going to her tomorrow. I hope we shall be able to take some care of Mr. Gargery together until he settles down."
"Well, how are you going to live, Biddy? If you want any money—"
"How am I going to live?"
repeated Biddy, striking in with a momentary flush upon her face.
"I'll tell you, Mr. Pip. I'm going to try to get the place of mistress in the new school nearly finished here. I can be well recommended by all the neighbours, and I hope I can be industrious and patient, and teach myself while I teach others. You know, Mr. Pip," pursued Biddy with a smile as she raised her eyes to my face, "the new schools are not like the old, but I learnt a good deal from you after that time, and have had time since then to improve."
"I think you would always improve, Biddy, under any circumstances."
"Ah, except in my bad side of human nature," murmured Biddy. It was not so much a reproach as an irresistible thinking aloud. Well, I thought, I would give up that point, too. So I walked a little further with Biddy, looking silently at her downcast eyes.
"I've not heard the particulars of my sister's death, Biddy."
"They're very slight, poor thing. She had been in one of her bad states, though they had got better of late rather than worse, for 4 days, when she came out of it in the evening, just at tea-time, and said quite plainly, 'Joe.' As she had never said any word for a long while, I ran and fetched in Mr. Gargery from the forge. She made signs to me that she wanted him to sit down close to her, and wanted me to put her arms around his neck. So I put them round his neck, and she laid her head down on his shoulder, quite content and satisfied. And so she presently said, 'Joe,' again, and once, 'Pardon,' and once, 'Pip.' And so she never lifted her head up any more, and it was just an hour later when we laid it down on her own bed, because we found she was gone."
Biddy cried. The darkening garden and the lane and the stars that were coming out were blurred in my own sight.
"Nothing was ever discovered, Biddy."
"Nothing." "Do you know what has become of Orlick?"
"I should think, from the colour of his clothes, that he is working in the quarries."
"Of course you have seen him, then. But why are you looking at that dark tree in the lane?"
"I saw him there, on the night she died."
"That was not the last time either, Biddy."
"No. I have seen him there since we've been walking here." "It's of no use," said Biddy, laying her hand upon my arm, as I was for running out. "You know I would not deceive you. He was not there a minute, and he is gone."
It revived my utmost indignation to find that she was still pursued by this fellow, and I felt inveterate against him. I told her so, and I told her that I would spend any money or take any pains to drive him out of that country. By degrees, she led me into more temperate talk, and she told me how Joe loved me, and how Joe never complained of anything. She didn't say of me. She had no need. I knew what she meant. But ever did his duty in his way of life, with a strong hand, a quiet tongue, and a gentle heart. Indeed, it would be hard to say too much for him, said I. And, Biddy, we must often speak of these things, for, of course, I shall be often down here now. I'm not going to leave poor Joe alone. Biddy said never a single word. Biddy, don't you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Pip.
Not to mention your calling me Mr. Pip, which appears to me to be in bad taste, Biddy. What do you mean?
What do I mean?
Asked Biddy timidly. Biddy, said I in a virtuously self-asserting manner, I must request to know what you mean by this.
By this, said Biddy.
Now don't echo, I retorted. You used not to echo, Biddy.
Used not, said Biddy. Oh, Mr. Pip, used.
Well, I rather thought I would give up that point, too. After another silent turn in the garden, I fell back on the main position. Biddy, said I made a remark respecting my coming down here often to see Joe, which you received with marked silence. Have the goodness, Biddy, to tell me why.
Are you quite sure, then, that you will come to see him often?
Asked Biddy, stopping in the narrow garden walk and looking at me under the stars with a clear and honest eye. Oh, dear me, said I, as I found myself compelled to give up Biddy in despair. This really is a very bad side of human nature. Don't say any more, if you please, Biddy. This shocks me very much. For which cogent reason I kept Biddy at a distance during supper, and when I went up to my own old little room, took as stately a leave of her as I could, in my murmuring soul, deem reconcilable with the churchyard and the event of the day. As often as I was restless in the night, and that was every quarter of an hour, I reflected what an unkindness, what an injury, what an injustice Biddy had done me. Early in the morning I was to go. Early in the morning I was out, and looking in unseen at one of the wooden windows of the forge, there I stood for minutes, looking at Joe, already at work with a glow of health and strength upon his face that made it show as if the bright sun of the life in store for him were shining on it. Goodbye, dear Joe. No, don't wipe it off. For God's sake, give me your blackened hand. I shall be down soon and often.
Never too soon, sir, said Joe. And never too often, Pip.
Biddy was waiting for me at the kitchen door, with a mug of new milk and a crust of bread. Biddy, said I when I gave her my hand at parting, I'm not angry, but I am hurt.
No, don't be hurt, she pleaded quite pathetically. Let only me be hurt, if I have been ungenerous.
Once more, the mists were rising as I walked away. If they disclosed to me, as I suspect they did, that I should not come back, and that Biddy was quite right, all I can say is, they were quite right, too.
Chapter 36 Herbert and I went on from bad to worse in the way of increasing our debts, looking into our affairs, leaving margins and the like exemplary transactions. And time went on, whether or no, as he has a way of doing, and I came of age, in fulfilment of Herbert's prediction that I should do so before I knew where I was. Herbert himself had come of age 8 months before me. As he had nothing else than his majority to come into, the event did not make a profound sensation in Barnard's Inn. But we had looked forward to my 21st birthday with a crowd of speculations and anticipations, for we had both considered that my guardian could hardly help saying something definite on that occasion. I had taken care to have it well understood in Little Britain when my birthday was. On the day before it, I received an official note from Wemmick, informing me that Mr. Jaggers would be glad if I would call upon him at 5 in the afternoon of the auspicious day. This convinced us that something great was to happen, and threw me into an unusual flutter when I repaired to my guardian's office, a model of punctuality. In the outer office, Wemmick offered me his congratulations, and incidentally rubbed the sides of his nose with a folded piece of tissue paper that I liked the look of. But he said nothing respecting it, and motioned me with a nod into my guardian's room. It was November,
and my guardian was standing before his fire, leaning his back against the chimney-piece, with his hands under his coat-tails.
"Well, Pip," said he, "I must call you Mr. Pip today. Congratulations, Mr. Pip."
We shook hands. He was always a remarkably short shaker, and I thanked him.
"Take a chair, Mr. Pip," said my guardian.
As I sat down, and he preserved his attitude and bent his brows at his boots, I felt at a disadvantage, which reminded me of that old time when I had been put upon a tombstone. The two ghastly casts on the shelf were not far from him, and their expression was as if they were making a stupid, apoplectic attempt to attend to the conversation.
"Now, my young friend,"
my guardian began, as if I were a witness in the box,
"I am going to have a word or two with you."
"If you please, sir."
"What do you suppose?"
said Mr. Jaggers, bending forward to look at the ground, and then throwing his head back to look at the ceiling.
"What do you suppose you are living at the rate of?"
"At the rate of, sir?"
"At," repeated Mr. Jaggers, still looking at the ceiling, "the rate of."
And then looked all around the room, and paused with his pocket handkerchief in his hand, halfway to his nose. I had looked into my affairs so often that I had thoroughly destroyed any slight notion I might ever have had of their bearings. Reluctantly, I confessed myself quite unable to answer the question. This reply seemed agreeable to Mr. Jaggers, who said,
"I thought so,"
and blew his nose with an air of satisfaction.
"Now I have asked you a question, my friend," said Mr. Jaggers. "Have you anything to ask me?"
"Of course it would be a great relief to me to ask you several questions, sir, but I remember your prohibition."
"Ask one," said Mr. Jaggers.
"Is my benefactor to be made known to me today?"
"No. Ask another."
"Is that confidence to be imparted to me soon?"
"Waive that a moment," said Mr. Jaggers, "and ask another."
I looked about me, but there appeared to be now no possible escape from the inquiry. "Have I anything to receive, sir?" On that Mr. Jaggers said triumphantly,
"I thought we should come to it,"
and called to Wemmick to give him that piece of paper. Wemmick appeared, handed it in, and disappeared.
"Now, Mr. Pip," said Mr. Jaggers, "attend, if you please. You have been drawing pretty freely here. Your name occurs pretty often in Wemmick's cash-book. But you are in debt, of course."
"I'm afraid I must say yes, sir."
"You know you must say yes, don't you?"
said Mr. Jaggers.
"Yes, sir."
"I don't ask you what you owe, because you don't know. And if you did know, you wouldn't tell me. You would say less." "Yes, yes, my friend," cried Mr. Jaggers, waving his forefinger to stop me as I made a show of protesting. "It's likely enough that you think you wouldn't, but you would. You'll excuse me, but I know better than you. Now, take this piece of paper in your hand. You've got it? Very good. Now unfold it and tell me what it is."
"This is a banknote," said I, "for £500.
"That is a banknote," repeated Mr. Jaggers, "for £500, and a very handsome sum of money, too, I think. You consider it so?"
"How could I do otherwise?"
"Ah, but answer the question," said Mr. Jaggers.
"Undoubtedly."
"You consider it undoubtedly a handsome sum of money. Now that handsome sum of money, Pip, is your own. It is a present to you on this day, in earnest of your expectations. And at the rate of that handsome sum of money per annum, and at no higher rate, you are to live until the donor of the whole appears. That is to say, you will now take your money affairs entirely into your own hands, and you will draw from Wemmick £125 per quarter until you are in communication with the Fountainhead, and no longer with a mere agent. As I have told you before, I am the mere agent. I execute my instructions, and I am paid for doing so. I think them injudicious, but I am not paid for giving any opinion on their merits."
I was beginning to express my gratitude to my benefactor,
for the great liberality with which I was treated, when Mr. Jaggers stopped me.
"I am not paid, Pip," said he coolly, "to carry your words to anyone,"
and then gathered up his coat-tails, as he had gathered up the object, and stood frowning at his boots as if he suspected them of designs against him. After a pause, I hinted, "There was a question just now, Mr. Jaggers, which you desired me to waive for a moment. I hope I am doing nothing wrong in asking it again."
"What is it?" said he.
I might have known that he would never help me out, but it took me aback to have to shape the question afresh, as if it were quite new. "Is it likely," I said after hesitating, "that my patron, the fountainhead you have spoken of, Mr. Jaggers, will soon—" There I delicately stopped.
"Will soon what?" asked Mr. Jaggers. "That's no question as it stands, you know."
"Will soon come to London," said I, after casting about for a precise form of words, "or summon me anywhere else."
"Now here,"
replied Mr. Jaggers, fixing me for the first time with his dark, deep-set eyes.
"We must revert to the evening when we first encountered one another in your village. What did I tell you then, Pip?"
"You told me, Mr. Jaggers, that it might be years hence when that person appeared."
"Just so," said Mr. Jaggers. "That's my answer."
As we looked full at one another, I felt my breath come quicker in my strong desire to get something out of him. And as I felt that it came quicker, and as I felt that he saw that it came quicker, I felt that I had less chance than ever of getting anything out of him. "Do you suppose it will still be years hence, Mr. Jaggers?" Mr. Jaggers shook his head, not in negativing the question, but in altogether negativing the notion that he could anyhow be got to answer it. And the two horrible casts of the twitched faces looked, when my eyes strayed up to them, as if they had come to a crisis in their suspended attention and were going to sneeze.
"Come,"
said Mr. Jaggers, warming the backs of his legs with the backs of his warmed hands.
"I'll be plain with you, my friend Pip. That's a question I must not be asked. You will understand that better when I tell you it's a question that might compromise me. Come, I'll go a little further with you. I'll say something more."
He bent down so low to frown at his boots that he was able to rub the calves of his legs in the pause he made.
"When that person discloses," said Mr. Jaggers, straightening himself, "you and that person will settle your own affairs. When that person discloses, my part in this business will cease and determine. When that person discloses, it will not be necessary for me to know anything about it. And that's all I've got to say."
We looked at one another until I withdrew my eyes and looked thoughtfully at the floor. From this last speech, I derived the notion that Miss Havisham, for some reason or no reason, had not taken him into her confidence as to her designing me for Estella, that he resented this and felt a jealousy about it, or that he really did object to that scheme and would have nothing to do with it. When I raised my eyes again, I found that he had been shrewdly looking at me all the time, and was doing so still. "If that is all you have to say, sir," I remarked, "there can be nothing left for me to say." He nodded assent, and pulled out his thief-dreaded watch, and asked me where I was going to dine. I replied at my own chambers with Herbert. As a necessary sequence, I asked him if he would favour us with his company, and he promptly accepted the invitation. But he insisted on walking home with me in order that I might make no extra preparation for him, and first he had a letter or two to write and, of course, had his hands to wash. So I said I would go into the outer office and talk to Wemmick. The fact was that when the £500 had come into my pocket, a thought had come into my head, which had been often there before, and it appeared to me that Wemmick was a good person to advise with concerning such thought. He had already locked up his safe and made preparations for going home. He had left his desk, brought out his two greasy office candlesticks, and stood them in line with the snuffers on a slab near the door, ready to be extinguished. He had raked his fire low, put his hat and greatcoat ready,
and was beating himself all over the chest with his safe key as an athletic exercise after business.
"Mr. Wemmick," said I want to ask your opinion. I'm very desirous to serve a friend."
Wemmick